There were others. Occasionally, Zuga spied the smoke from a cooking fire rising from the highest point at one of the strangely shaped rock hillocks that dotted the land in all directions. If these were the survivors of the vanished civilization, then they still lived in terror of the fate that had overtaken their forebears. When Zuga and his hunting party approached any of these tiny elevated settlements, they found the crests were fortified with built-up walls of rock, and they were greeted with a hail of boulders rolled down the slope upon them that forced them to retreat hurriedly. Often there were small cultivated gardens on the level ground below the fortified hilltops. In the gardens grew millet, rapoco, and big sweet yams, but most important for Zuga, dark green native tobacco. The soil was rich, the rapoco grew twice the height of a man, and the corn sprays were loaded with red grain. The tobacco leaves were thick-stemmed, the size of an elephant's ear. Zuga rolled the tipped leaves into powerful cigars that had a rich distinction of taste, and as he smoked them, he pondered how the plant had reached this distant land from its far origins. There must once have been an avenue of trade between these people and the coast. The trade beads on the necklace he had taken from the body at the pass, and now these exotic plants proved that, as did the tamarind trees, native of India, which grew amongst the ruins of the ancient villages. Zuga wondered what a colony of British settlers, with their industry and sophisticated agricultural technique, plough and crop rotation, seed selection and fertilization, might make of this lush, rich soil, as he moved on slowly through the sparsely populated, well-timbered land that abounded with game and game birds, and was fed by strong, clear streams of water. Whenever he returned to the main body of the caravan, he made his meticulous observations of the sun and worked with chronometer and almanac to compute his exact positions, to add them, and his own succinct descriptions, to the map that old Tom Harkness had bequeathed him. The map increased in value, as new rivers were marked in, new boundaries set to the fly belts and the fly corridors extended, as Zuga's observations of the terrain, of soil and vegetation types, began to cover the blank portions of the old parchment. If he was not immersed in his map, then he worked as long as the light was good enough on his journal and the manuscript, which was an adjunct to it. And while he did so, Yan Shirut and the porters brought in the latest harvest of ivory, only just beginning to stink, and buried it. Totaling the harvest from the lists in his journal, Zuga found that he had over 12,000 pounds of tusks cached along his route. They were worth 6 shillings a pound in London, nearly 4,000 pounds sterling. The trick was to get it to London. Zuga grinned to himself as he completed the calculation. 12 wagons, or 500 porters, and 2,000 miles to carry it. That was all it required. At each river crossing, Zuga took the flat black iron pan, which doubled as laundry tub and cooking pot, and for miles in each direction along the riverbed, he worked the gravel. He would fill the pan from a likely spot under the bank in the bend of the river, and then set the contents swirling awash, dipping and turning the pan, spilling a little of the lighter gravel at each turn, refilling with water and spinning it again, until at last he was left with a smear of the finest and heaviest material lying around the bottom of the pan, in a tail. Always the tail was dark and uninteresting, without the golden sparkle for which he longed so ardently. When he detailed all these activities in his journal, only one thing gave Zuga a pause, and that was what to call this new and beautiful land. So far there was no evidence at all that it was the empire of Monomotapa, or even that Monomotapa existed. The timid, scattered, and demoralized people he had so far encountered were certainly not the warriors of a powerful emperor. One other consideration decided him not to use that name. If he did so, it was tacit acknowledgement that the land had already been claimed, and each day that he travelled through the empty wilderness, the dreams of himself claiming it for a queen and a nation seemed less far-fetched. Zuga began to use the name Zambezia, the land below the Zambezi River, and that was how he wrote it in his journal, and in the thick bundle of pages of his manuscript. With all this work to impede progress, the pace of the caravan was leisurely, or, as Robin told Zuga furiously, "You would make a snail look like a derby winner." For although Zuga might cover 200 miles in the sweeping circular patterns of the hunt, the caravan camped and waited for his return, and then waited another 4 or 5 days as Yan Shirut and the porters ferried in the loads of wet ivory. "For all you know, Morris Zuga, your own father might be dying out there somewhere for want of a handful of medicine, while you, if he has survived 8 years already, the old devil is unlikely to turn up his toes for another few days." Zuga's tone covered the irritation he felt. Since he had killed the Mashona at the pass on the Elephant Road, the feeling between brother and sister had been strained to the point where each of them found it difficult to maintain a civil tone of voice on the very few occasions when they spoke together. Zuga's long and frequent absences from the main body were not entirely on account of his dedication to the chase and exploration of the surrounding countryside. He found it less wearying on the nerves to be away from his sister. That ecstatic mood when they had stood like two children on Christmas morning, hand in hand, upon the heights of the escarpment, was months in the past. Brooding beside his solitary campfire, with the hyena giggling and shrieking over the freshly killed elephant carcasses in the nearby forest, Zuga thought how it was really a miracle that two such definite personalities as his and Robin's, whose objects were so widely divergent, should have come this far without serious disagreement. It had been too good to last indefinitely, and now he wondered how it might end. He should have followed his instincts and sent Robin back to Tet and Cape Town, when he had the excuse to do so, for the collision course on which they were so clearly set could only end in disaster for the entire expedition. When he rejoined the main body the following day, he would have it out with her, one way or the other. She would have at last to accept that he was the leader of the expedition, and as such, his decisions were final. If she did so, then he could make some concession to her wishes, though the hunt for Fuller Ballantyne was very low on Zuga's list of priorities. It would probably be best for all of them, Fuller Ballantyne not excluded, if he had long ago been laid by his faithful bearers in a hero's grave. The thought gave Zuga a prick of guilt, and he knew he would never write it, not even in the most private pages of his journal, nor would he voice it to his sister. But the idea persisted, even while he rolled into his blanket, with a small fire at his feet and another at his head to break the thick crunching white frost which would cover the earth and grass at dawn, serenaded by Yan Shirut's snores, which took the basso profundo to the soprano of the hyena's packs. Zuga fell asleep at last. Having made the decision to assert his authority, Zuga rolled out of his blanket in the frosty dawn, determined on a forced march that would take them back to where he had left Robin and the caravan 12 days previously. He reckoned it was 40 miles, perhaps a little less, to the main campsite, and he set a cruel pace, not even taking the usual noon break, but pushing on remorselessly. Zuga had deliberately left the main body and camped below a distinctively shaped koppie whose rocky spires could be clearly seen from many miles around, and which Zuga had named Mount Hamden in memory of a child visit to that castle. They were still far out when Zuga had his first misgivings. There was no smoke rising from the base of the hills, and there should have been. He had left almost a ton of elephant meat curing on the smoking racks, and on the outward march he had been able to look back and see the rising column of smoke long after the crests of the hills had disappeared below the tops of the forest trees. "There's no smoke," he told Yan Shirut, and the little Hottentot nodded.
"I did not want to be the first to say that."
"Can Comancho have followed us this far?"
"There are other man-eating animals here beside the Portuguese,"
Yan Shirut said, and cocked his head at an inquisitive bird-like angle, as Zuga began swiftly to strip down to light running order. Then, still without another word, Yan Shirut followed his example and handed his breeches and other traps to the bearers. "Follow as fast as you can," Zuga told them, snatching a spare powder bag from Matthew, and turning away and breaking into a run. Yan Shirut fell in at his shoulder, and they ran, as they had run so often before, at the driving pace which could bring a breeding herd of elephant to a winded standstill within a few miles. All Zuga's feelings of antagonism towards his sister were swept away in the rush of deep concern for her safety. A series of horrific images flashed through his mind, of a sacked campsite, of mutilated bodies lying in the bloody trampled grass, shattered by the balls of the Portuguese muskets, or stabbed to death by the broad-bladed assegais of plumed and kilted warriors. He found himself praying for her safety, repeating the formulas of his childhood, which he had used so seldom since then, and unconsciously he increased the pace until Yan Shirut grunted a protest at his shoulder, and then slowly fell back, as Zuga forged powerfully ahead. He reached the foot of the hill a mile ahead of Yan Shirut, and turned to face the lowering red orb of the sun as he skirted the rocky base, crested a low rise, and stopped there, hunting for breath, his chest swelling and subsiding, and the sweat running down into his beard. He stared down at the shaded dell, under the tall mukuzi trees, where he had left the caravan, and his heart plunged. He felt physically nauseated with horror. The campsite was deserted. The fires were cold black ash, and the thatched lean-to shelters had already acquired that dejected air of all deserted habitation. Still fighting for breath, Zuga plunged down the gentle slope into the abandoned camp and looked about him wildly for the bodies. There were none, and his first thought was of slavers. They would have taken them all, and he shuddered with horror at the thought of what Robin must have suffered. Zuga ran to her hut first. It was totally devoid of any trace of her. He ran to the next hut and the next. All of them were empty. But in the last hut he found a single body. It was curled on the sandy floor of the primitive shelter and wrapped in a blanket. The blanket was drawn up over the head and wound tightly around the trunk. Reluctant to discover his sister's horribly mutilated corpse, Zuga knelt beside it. Sweat half blinded him as he reached out a hand that trembled with dread and exhaustion and gently drew back the fold of a grey blanket that covered the still head. The corpse came to life with a howl of fright and leapt 2 feet into the air, gibbering wildly, trying to throw off the blanket and lashing out with feet and fists to defend itself. Hellhound! Zuga had so christened the laziest of his porters, a skinny fellow with a vast appetite for meat and less enthusiasm for anything that involved physical exertion. What has happened? Where is Nomuza? Hellhound, once he had been quieted and had sufficiently recovered from shock, had a brief note to answer his questions. The single scrap of paper, torn from Robin's journal, was double-folded and sealed with a splash of red wax. It read, "Dear Zuga, I am of the opinion that further delay will seriously prejudice the interests of the sponsors of this expedition. Accordingly, I have decided to move on at a speed better suited to achieving our objects before the onset of the rainy season. I leave Hellhound to await your eventual return. Do follow at your own speed. Your affectionate sister, Robin." The note was dated 10 days previously, and it was all she had left him. There was not even a pouch of salt or a bag of tea leaves, both of which commodities Zuga had been without for days. Zuga's numbing shock lasted until Yan Shirut reached the deserted camp, but by the time his exhausted bearers came, black rage had begun to replace all other emotion. He would have made a night march of it in pursuit of the caravan, but though he kicked their ribs as they lay and cursed them coldly, his bearers were so exhausted that they could not rise from where they had thrown themselves down.